Hey everyone, I'm Asia.
And I'm Devin, and we are your hosts, and this is the latest episode of On Their Behalf.
So you know how much I love Jackson, right?
Of course, he's your sweet puppy.
I do love him very, very much, but there's sometimes when I'm literally like, why? I saw a video or a picture. Yeah, it was a video on TikTok. I'm not a TikToker. I don't actually post TikToks. Mm-hmm. I don't make them. But somebody posted a video that was basically like, oh, I love my dog. But like totally, is there ever a time where you are like, oh my God, like what is wrong with this dog? And one of the girls posted a picture of her dog ripped up her memory foam mattress, like, completely. Oh, like, it was just shredded. And, like, I know, and there's going to be people that say, like, oh, yeah, it's just anxiety. They have separation anxiety. But, like, sometimes dogs are just jerks. And they just want to make you suffer because you've left them alone for whatever reason. So I spent a lot of money on a night guard because I grind my teeth. Mm-hmm. Apparently that's genetic as well.
I've been
telling my whole family, like, maybe you should go to the dentist and find out if you grind your teeth. It's really expensive. Insurance does not cover the whole thing. And somehow he got a hold of it and completely ate it.
No.
Like, I'm not saying like he chewed it up. He actually like ate it.
Oh my gosh, does he have like a tummy ache or something? Or he's just like fine.
He's a functioning puppy in society right now. He does not give a shit that he ate like a bunch of plastic. When I was like looking at the pieces of it, I'm like, what is this? And then when I went to bed and couldn't find my night guard, I was like, that's what that was. And it's almost, like, ironic because a night guard is literally there so that, like, you don't chew hard on your, like...
And then he chewed through it.
And then he can chew through a night guard. It's just, I'm so angry. I'm so, like, not... I called my dentist and they're literally like, yeah, insurance only covers once a year. So I just have to pay out of pocket for another one. I am just...
Oh, I'm so sorry. That sucks so bad.
It's literally like, I just have to keep saying, I love my dog. I love my dog. I love my dog. I love my dog. I've had to do that at jobs before. Like, oh my God, I love my job. But this is like totally for this 11-pound just ball of jerkness that has literally ruined my day. And the next 5 days that I have to go to sleep without my night guard and wake up with a headache because he chewed it. Anywho.
Rough.
It's a rough world out here.
Rough world.
Well, this week, to take my mind off of my night guard, I did research a story that, like, is so heartbreaking. And weirdly, this is like one of the stories that like there is quite a bit of information about it. Mm-hmm. So I was like, oh, okay. You know, like it was widely reported on, and very similar to a lot of the cases that we do. Mm-hmm. So this week I'm going to tell the case on behalf of Deborah Danner. On October 18th, 2016, at 6:05 p.m., police responded to a 911 call made by the neighbor of Deborah Danner. It was a cluttered seventh-floor apartment building. It was on Pugsley Avenue in Castle Hill, in a section of Brooklyn, New York, or I'm sorry, the Bronx, New York. Mm. This neighbor reported that Deborah was behaving erratically and called the police to come and de-escalate the situation, mm-hmm. which many
we
of us know.
How that goes.
Exactly. But this is also not the first time that the police have been called to her apartment for calls like this. Mm-hmm. So not saying that the police like knew her by name or anything like that, mm-hmm. but it was a location where they were aware, were visited by police often. Mm-hmm. So the police show up to the apartment building, including Sergeant Hugh Barry and five other officers. Mm-hmm. Were there, and also two like medical personnel, like first responders type EMTs situation. Yeah. So, but according to the police, Deborah had scissors in her hand, mm-hmm. and Sergeant Barry went in to talk her into putting the scissors down. By his account and the police account, they say that she then picked up a baseball bat and swung it at him. Hmm. So Sergeant Barry, for whatever reason, responds by shooting Deborah twice. She is rushed to the Jacoby Hospital, where she later passes away from her injuries. Oof. Deborah Danner's death spurred citywide protest and obvious justifiable anger across the African American community. She was 66 years old. Mm. The mayor, Bill de Blasio, That's how you say it?
Yeah.
Bill de Blasio.
Very
okay.
famous.
Oh, really? I've never heard of him. And I'm from New York. So there you go.
All right.
He made a statement after criticizing Barry, saying, quote, his breach of proper protocol, and he called the event a tragic and unacceptable. So I agree with you. So let's talk a little bit about Deborah Danner. If you didn't pick up on some of the clues, Deborah was mentally ill. Mm-hmm. And like I said earlier, this wasn't the first time that police responded to a call at her place of residence. And it wasn't uncommon for this to happen with Deborah and the police to get involved, mm-hmm. but it never escalated to something like this, mm-hmm. before. But you know, she was living with it. She was functioning fairly well in society. She was a parishioner, and regularly attended a church, called the Trinity Church of Wall Street. And she was active in all of her church groups and ministries. Before her death, she was an IT, /MIS professional. Mm-hmm. She was super smart, and she loved spending time with her church family. Like, that was her, outside of work, that's what she mm-hmm. did. If she wasn't at home or at work, that's where she was, at her church serving. So in 2014, she graduated with a bachelor's in computer science and from the New York State Institute of Technology in Manhattan. She also wrote an essay called Living with Schizophrenia in 2012. This essay described her experience with mental illness, her strained relationship with her family. She also tells of the times that she faced discrimination from employers and other employees that she worked with, and just the general stigma around just regular encounters of, you know, discrimination due to her condition. Mm-hmm. And I read through her essay, and it basically just talks about, like, how hard it was for her to find work. Mm-hmm. And even with her intel, like, she was so fucking smart, and she had these degrees in, like, computer science, and she was an amazing writer. Like, even all of those things didn't matter because she was suffering from schizophrenia. It was just kind of difficult for her to find even a place to live at some point.
Yeah.
So she writes about the experiences of being hospitalized 10 times during her life. And ironically, in this essay, she discusses the danger that the police encounters present to people living with mental illness. Mm. She says, quote, "Any chronic illness is a curse. Schizophrenia is no different. Its only saving grace, if you will, is that, as far as I know, it's not a fatal disease." Mm. End quote. Just over 4 years after her death, Deborah's words would come to haunt her family as they, you know, mourned her death. When, like we said earlier, the NYPD Sergeant Hugh Barry fatally shoots her because she was, quote, acting erratically. Mm-hmm. According to
that
her
was,
sister.
Sorry, just to clarify, that was 4 years after she wrote the essay?
This is her... This is 4 years after she wrote the essay, okay. And this is her family's, like, account of, like, the aftermath of her death.
Okay. Okay.
Kind of thing, yeah. So her sister, Jennifer Danner, she does an interview, and she says that the police responding to this situation was absurd. Mm-hmm. She said that usually the ESU responds to an emergency, high-risk situation, and the ESU is the Emergency Services Union, mm-hmm. and it basically, they come in when the situation falls outside of the duties of, like, a patrol officer or a criminal investigation. Like, this is not a criminal situation.
Right.
It's just, you know, this is a person who is dealing with mental health issues that needs a social worker type person to come in and de-escalate the situation, not the police.
And somebody trained to know.
To deal with that situation.
Yeah.
And she, she's basically like, the police are always called because that's what you call when, you know, you call 911.
Yeah, as a society, we've been trained that's the only recourse.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And she is saying that, like, in the past, of course the police show up as well, but because they know Deborah and they know this location and her neighbors know the situation, ESU should have also been there at the time. She said that ESU is, their main job is to provide a crisis response to incidents involving emotionally disturbed persons, or EDP. Mm-hmm. That's how they label it. So she says that the ESU actually looks like a SWAT team, and they... the ESU responds to these types of situations. And she has spoken to an ESU responder before who told her that in previous incidents, you know, with her sister, they usually plan to use a baton. And with this baton, they push her sister so that she falls backward, and that they're able to then use their shields so that they can get her down on the floor. So that they don't get hurt and that she doesn't get hurt.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's normally what happens.
Mm-hmm.
But obviously that's not the case this time. So less than 6 hours after the death of Deborah, Sergeant Barry was placed on administrative duty, and he was stripped of his badge and his gun. According to the New York Times, Mayor Bill de Blasio, hello, again, sir, said in a news conference that the sergeant had not followed training or protocols for dealing with those with mental health illnesses, and for some reason had neither used his taser nor his or specialized officers that are trained to deal with such situations, end quote.
Thank you for clarifying that.
Yeah.
That feels which is like you feel like this.
Yeah, like it's just like, okay, if this person, anyway.
But I guess it is a big deal for the mayor to acknowledge that.
Yeah.
Even stating facts is, what a sad world where even stating facts is.
Is, yeah.
Controversial. It's just,
and for him to not, like, for him to be the one that has to say that, it just feels like there's so many other people that this situation either trickled down to or went up to that they could be the ones to be like, hey, yeah, this was not handled correctly. Like, why does the fucking mayor have to get up and say some shit like this that everybody should know? It should be common knowledge, especially in law enforcement. Like, it just doesn't make any sense. The death of Deborah, who was a Black elderly woman dealing with mental health issues, spurred a protest because she was killed by a white police officer. Mm-hmm. There was a protest on October 19th, and this march went from her apartment building to the 43rd Precinct Station House, where they sat for, you know, for days, really. Like, they protested for days after this happened. The NYPD did, you know, enact a disciplinary action against the sergeant. And within 6 hours, excuse me, he was suspended without pay. Mm-hmm. And on May 31st, 2017, Barry was arrested and charged second-degree murder, second-degree manslaughter, and criminally negligent homicide.
Wow.
Yeah. But...
I mean, I don't feel like my hope is going to last, but...
But this arrest. Is kind of... He was arrested, yes, and put on suspension without pay. Mm-hmm. But I think that the mayor's involvement in this and this being kind of, like, really public in that way is probably why this happened.
Yeah.
But if you remember correctly, those three charges were the exact charges that they... against... what's his name?
Derek Chauvin.
Yep, those are the exact three charges that he was charged with for killing. Yeah, it's crazy. So I was like, oh, all right. I was hopeful, and then, you know. So then the trial begins. Barry claims that he shot Deborah in self-defense after seeing her armed with a pair of scissors and then later in the bedroom with a bat that she had swung in his direction. Not only does her family not believe this, but other officers and the medical personnel at the scene say that this could not have gone down the way that he's saying it went down.
Whoa.
Because of the distance between Barry and Deborah. And especially because from the distance that they were, that her swinging a bat at him could not have posed enough threat that he would needed to discharge his weapon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, I mean,
yeah. But by his account, he followed Deborah into the bedroom where she was running from police. He shot her twice because she swung at him. And she succumbed to her wounds later, but he was the only one in the bedroom with her.
Oh, so he could say whatever.
So he can say whatever he wants. Jennifer, Deborah's sister, testified that she was there when Deborah was shot. And she said, quote, "There were four policemen there already. None of the four other officers who were there had pulled their guns. And then Sergeant Barry shows up with his driver, and he had coaxed her out of the bedroom. And then 5 minutes later, after he arrived, she was shot."
What the hell?
Yeah. It's, and even, like, reading through a lot of the accounts of, like, what happened, it was, like, it seemed like everybody that was there before he was there was de-escalating the situation. Like, I'll get into some of the other testimonies as well, but, like, it seems like until he showed up, everything was kind of getting better.
Yeah.
Like, from what people are saying, and even her sister. Like, her sister was there. She knew what was going on.
Yeah.
But as soon as he showed up, then all of a sudden she's dead? Like, it just didn't make any sense. There were so many other people there before he even showed up, and it nobody was felt that they were threatened enough where they needed to pull out their gun and shoot her.
Yeah.
So Barry claims that he knew that the police had been called to Deborah's home several times before, and when he arrived, he and the other officers were warned that she was, quote, a violent EDP, emotionally disturbed person. Mm-hmm. And it's also unclear who told him that.
Mm-hmm.
If it was the person who called the police, or if it was other officers that were already there.
Yeah.
It's just unclear about who, but he's the only one that's saying that.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, okay, so you and what other officers were told that she was violent?
Yeah.
But again, Jennifer states in her testimony that in previous instances, the ESU had been able to subdue Deborah without using excessive force. Sergeant Barry and the five other officers and two emergency medical technicians, were all testified during this trial. And they said that they all testified that they were called in because Deborah was ranting loudly in the hallway. So one of the neighbors called the police.
Mm-hmm.
Sergeant Barry's lawyer, Andrew C. Quinn, said in his opening statement that his client talked in a calm voice with Miss Deborah when he arrived at the apartment and persuaded her to lay the scissors down. But after he could not persuade her to come further than the doorway of her bedroom, he and the other officers tried to subdue her. He says that she retreated into the bedroom and picked up a bat. He drew his gun, told her to drop it. She refused and began swinging at him, so he fired twice at her. Senior police officers outlined a similar version of events that, you know, happened before and after the killing. And according to a testimony of Officer Camillo Rosario, one of the five officers that was present at the time,
mm-hmm.
He said that, you know, they arrived at the apartment to find Miss Deborah sitting on her bed, which, okay, I'm just going to go
different, like, story than all of it.
Yeah, like, and everybody gives kind of a different account, and then we'll talk about it. But okay. I'll just say, like, what everybody is saying. So mm-hmm. Sergeant Camillo Rosario is saying that they arrived, she was sitting on the bed, she was holding a pair of scissors, and she threatened to fight police if they entered the room.
Mm-hmm.
After a few minutes of attempting to persuade her to put the scissors down, Sergeant Barry entered the room to take Deborah into custody. And then at that point, she reached for the baseball bat, raised it at shoulder length, and swung at him. He pulled his gun out, asked her to put it down, and when she made a step toward him, and it was there was like a 4 to 5 foot gap between them. So that's what Rosario was saying, mm-hmm. that there's 5 feet. What, did she have a 5 foot bat?
Yeah.
So he fired his weapon. But here it's saying that Rosario's account contradicts the initial report, which claimed that Deborah attempted to swing the bat at Barry before he shot. So it was like, okay, and what happened to, like, she was in the hallway first and then went into the bedroom now, and there was nobody in the bedroom with him.
Yeah.
But now you're saying that, or Rosario was saying that he witnessed the entire thing.
Yeah.
And there was a 4 to 5 foot gap in between them. He shot her twice. It's just, like, I think that, everybody was backtracking after it happened to try to piece together what went down so that everybody's story matched.
Yeah.
Especially in the police department. Like, it felt like the five police officers were kind of coached as to what to say went down.
Mm-hmm.
Especially, he's a sergeant, too. Yeah. So it's like, of course.
Yeah. I was going to say that, but then I was like, I don't actually know about rank, so.
Yeah, I really don't either, but I'm assuming a sergeant is of a higher rank than, like, just a patrol officer that was called to the scene.
Yeah.
Okay, so then there was another testimony by Brittany Mullings. She was one of the emergency medical technicians. She says that she arrived before Barry, and Miss Deborah insisted that she be allowed to speak to the medical technicians rather than the police officers. So the police officers that were already there, they backed off and let Brittany take over and just, like, you know, sit down and try to talk with Deborah.
Mm-hmm.
So Brittany says that she entered the apartment and she stood a few feet away from Miss Deborah, who she said had nothing in her hands.
Whoa, not even the scissors?
Not even the scissors. She says that she tried to explain to Miss Deborah why the police had been called. And then Deborah stopped screaming, because I guess when she walked in, she was screaming and trying to figure out, like, who, why are you in my house? Like, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So she said she stopped screaming, but she was still agitated and talking very loudly.
Mm-hmm.
She said, quote, she was still trying to figure out who called 911 and why we were all there, end mm-hmm. quote. So if you're thinking, I mean, it's very hard to think from the perspective of somebody who's mentally ill, but even if you're not, and you're, you know, you are in your right mind, if I was in my apartment right now and two medical personnel and five police officers just show up to my house,
mm-hmm.
I'm going to be like, what the fuck are you guys doing here?
Yeah.
But in her mind, she's like, whoa, you know what I mean? Like, it, she's, mm-hmm. she's basically saying here that, like, she clearly did not understand what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
So, of course, it's a situation where she needs to be talked down from wherever she is, mm-hmm. and not, and, like, force should not have been used at all. But at this point, Brittany Mullings is like, okay, all right, she's calming down. She's mm-hmm. getting quieter. She's still yelling. She's still agitated, but it's working what I'm doing.
Mm-hmm.
So again, she says she wasn't holding anything in her hand. She was just alone in the hallway. She then tries to explain to Deborah why they are there. And while she's talking, that's when Sergeant Barry shows up with a couple other police officers.
Mm-hmm.
She says that he passes behind her in the living room, and, he's talking to another officer just a few feet behind her while she is talking to Deborah.
Uh-huh.
But then she says that she tells Deborah, like, as she's talking to Deborah and Sergeant is behind her talking to the other officers, she's telling Deborah, like, hey, you know, don't worry. Like, I just want to check and make sure that you're okay. Will you allow me to come toward you and check your health and make sure that you're all right?
Mm-hmm.
But she said that she couldn't finish that conversation with her because she's hearing the sergeant behind her with other officers, like, kind of like devising some sort of plan to subdue her.
No.
So she wasn't really able to finish the conversation because now Deborah is able to hear what they're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And so she says she overhears someone behind her say, are you ready? And then Deborah screams, ready for what?
Mm-hmm.
And that's when she said, all at once, Miss Deborah turns around. She goes, scurries back into the bedroom. And she says, then six officers, including the sergeant, follow her into the bedroom.
Mm-hmm.
She said she couldn't see anything but the top of Deborah's head,
mm-hmm.
and she did hear her screaming. And then a minute later, she said she heard an officer yell, get down, and then the two shots. Mm. So her account of the situation just doesn't match anybody's at this right. point. Not even Sergeant Barry, because he's saying that he showed up, she had scissors in her hand, he asked her to put the scissors down and she wouldn't, and then she grabbed a bat and swung the bat at him, and yeah. that's why he shot her twice, but nobody else was in the room. So
but
it's
she,
just
yeah but Brittany's testimony, she is the least at stake here. Mm-hmm. Right? So she's why would she reason to lie?
Yeah. And she's there for a reason. She's there right. as a she's a medical professional that's trying to de-escalate the situation for a woman that's clearly disturbed. And does she know her backstory? I don't know. I couldn't find if she had visited Miss Deborah before. Mm-hmm. It seems as if this is not, you know, the first time that someone has been there to try to de-escalate the situation, but that doesn't mean that this was Brittany right. before, you know?
Right.
So, the trial, they go through the trial, everybody does their testimonies, but on February 14th, 2018, Barry was acquitted by a judge of a non-jury trial. He acquits him and finds him innocent on all charges. I mean, I'm pissed.
But not surprised.
So, after the trial, Deborah's family, how are they not still just, like, in shock of his acquittal? Yeah. And, like, especially based on testimonies being so different and seeming like the police brotherhood is literally what's keeping him from...
Baby.
Yeah. That's the thing that it seems to be keeping him from being held accountable for his actions, because there's 5-6 police officers saying one thing and one medical, personnel that's saying another. Also, there was no jury, which I don't understand, but I guess there must have been I hope a valid reason for why that there was no jury of his peers, but I who knows?
Yeah, I don't know. That's odd.
Yeah.
Or
Jennifer.
Tactical.
Yeah. Yep. And you know, that makes a lot of sense too, because I was kind of like shocked that everything was seemingly going in their favor for a while.
Yeah.
Like he was, put on administrative leave. He wasn't being paid. He was arrested immediately. He was put on charges that were accurate to what his actions were. Yeah.
But that's all to appease the protesters and be like, we're doing it. We're doing it. We're doing it.
Yeah.
And then a non-jury trial is like, to be like, okay, well, like we said we were going to do something and like he got fired. Let's cover our asses and just
let's just leave it at that.
Make them think that they got what they wanted.
Yeah. Jennifer, Deborah's sister, says, quote, "I don't think there has been justice for the death of my sister. She was shot and killed by police because she was mentally ill." Jennifer also said that Deborah was known to behave erratically when she was off her medication.
Mm-hmm.
And it's known that like people dealing with mental health issues, they're on medication to help them feel better. So once they feel fine, they feel like they don't need it.
Yeah.
So then they stop.
Yeah. And then they stop taking it. There's also such a stigma about taking medicine, like that you're weak or that you can't fix it yourself and all this kind of stuff. That is really easy to internalize, but is absolutely not true. Like, medication is there to help and support. But then there's also a side of it where, you know, it can leave you feeling kind of foggy. It can leave you feeling different, and you don't feel like yourself.
Yeah.
And so there's lots of reasons why people go in and out of taking their medication. Because, to be honest, medication helps people function in society rather than society helping people that function differently. Not to undercut how valuable medication is and how there should be no shame and no stigma or anything around taking that to help and support yourself.
I completely agree, and I don't think that I think that mental illnesses are just that. They're illnesses that you can't control. If you, had a birth defect or you had a heart condition that, or people who are born with diabetes, like, it's not something that you can control. It's just something that your body physically lax, and those people are on medication.
Nexus stuff. It's just a difference.
Yeah, it's a, there's so many things that, you know, medication supports. So we, you know, I'm sure Devin agrees with me. You know, take your medication. Make sure that you're, even if you feel great or if you don't feel great, if you don't feel great, then talk to your doctor and make sure that your doctor has you on the right medication that will help you function and be the best that you can be. But like in this situation, it wasn't the first time that this has happened. Mm-hmm. And she, it wasn't like she was 20 years old. She was 66.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? She had been living with this for 66 years. So it's not... It feels like this is something her sister has to say to like justify her behavior, but really it should be the other way around. It shouldn't be making excuses as to why the police were called for this, you know, however many times.
Yeah, there should be a base level of understanding.
Exactly.
And even like the word like erratic and stuff, mm-hmm. I kind of am like, about it because like she's experiencing symptoms. Yeah. That's what's happening. That mm-hmm. from the it's almost like a word that is like framed from the ableist mindset, right? Where it's like it's erratic to somebody not experiencing that, but it's her part of her reality.
Yeah,
I'm not educated enough to like fully speak on what I'm trying to say, and I should do more research and learn more about it and everything, but. It really is a sort of like, yeah, like you're saying, like this isn't new to her. It's new to everybody else that's like called in to be an expert on the situation and then obviously are not. Mm-hmm. And then she ends up dead.
Yeah. And it's like, let's normalize that these symptoms that she's having are not... erratic. They're not, it's like somebody who has allergies and they're sneezing. It's not as simple as that, but it's a symptom that you can't control. She can't control it. And instead of throwing a police officer in there to deal with it and a sergeant at that, like what, why?
Yeah. So are they just going to be like, stop it? Cause that's not how that works.
No. Like if you're not trained to deal with a situation like this, you shouldn't be there. If I'm not trained to fly a fucking plane, there's no way I'm getting on a flight and being like, excuse me, move over so I can, you know, get everybody to Georgia. Like it's crazy. Like why would you throw a police officer in there to deal with a situation that he's not equipped to deal with?
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, so then her sister, you know, is just, I don't think that she needs to do this, but whatever, she feels the need to after her sister's murderer is set free, she's still answering questions to support, to justify her sister's behavior when, in fact, we should be
questioning the murderer's behavior.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So she does say at one point, she says, quote, never mind that on his gun belt, he had a taser and he had mace, but he chose to pull a gun and shoot her. He could have backed out of the apartment, called ESU and said, listen, this job is for you guys. Mm-hmm. But he did none of that stuff. He just shot her.
Yeah. It's like that phrase that it's like when all you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. You know?
Yeah.
So it's like, if the training for police officers was like, I mean, I guess they do say that it's like last resort training.
Yeah.
But like the amount in LAPD anyways that spends on training bullets and training and the training for shooting versus unconscious bias training, which is like, millions and millions of dollars of ammunition for training rounds. Yeah. Versus a couple hundred thousand for like de-escalation and non-bias training. And you can see that all in the LA people's budget.
Mm-hmm.
It's all online. You guys can look at that yourselves.
Yeah.
But it's like, if that's truly last resort, then they would have done the plan that you just laid out.
Yeah. Yeah. And you wouldn't have taken somebody's sister away from them. Yeah. You know, it's like, come on, like be, and it's like, it feels like such a simple thing to say, but like, how about you act like a human being first?
Right.
Not a cop, not, you know, like, not a sergeant. Act like a human being. Walk into every situation like that's your family member. Yeah. Walk into the store and treat people as if, you know, that's somebody that you care about. Like, stop treating people like they're just disposable because they you know, you don't have any emotional connection to them. If we all led with that, I feel like the world would be a pleasanter place to be.
Oh, yeah. But you then know? It's like, how fragile must this Sergeant Barry be? Mm. Is that his name?
Yeah.
Where he's like a little bit afraid and then kills somebody because of it.
Yeah. For a bat. Like,
yeah, you have no... If you are that afraid...
Yeah, you shouldn't have a gun anyway.
A cop. Yeah.
Like, if a bat scares you, you shouldn't be a cop. You shouldn't have a gun.
Yeah.
Be a librarian then.
Don't go to baseball games.
No. Because God forbid.
God forbid.
Ed Mullins, he's the president of the NYPD's Sergeants Union, and he said, quote, "The way he handled himself in the moment was entirely appropriate. It was entirely consistent with good police tactics."
You know what, Ed? That is true.
You're true. You're right.
Good police tactics, because they define what good is, and all these fucking unions just suck each other's dick and try to protect each other.
Yep.
But because the goal of the good police tactics is not to protect and serve, it's to obliterate.
Exactly. And it's like, okay, great. Yeah, if you really want to assign that narrative to this situation, then you're only right in the fact that he acted like a police officer. There shouldn't have been a fucking police officer here to begin with. So how about we address that issue? So I don't understand.
Why are you there? Why were you even there? Nobody wants you here.
You weren't, so you should not have been there. And even if you are there for whatever reason, like if there is a legal reason why a police officer needs to accompany an ESU person or whatever, then okay, let that person take the lead. Why are you in the room with a mentally ill person who's wielding a bat? Why are you the one that's there? You shouldn't be. You should be on the sidelines observing and making sure that everybody is there being protected, not pulling your gun out and shooting somebody twice.
Yeah.
Oh, this just fucking, I literally, ugh. Anyway, so he said that, this Ed Mullins guy or whatever, he says that the suggestion that Barry could have done something different in the room, or that he, if he wouldn't have been there or did something different, then the outcome would have been different, was, quote, ridiculous. A ridiculous proposition. Mm. I'm like, you know what? You're a fucking ridiculous proposition. Get the hell out of here. This was like one of the quotes that I pulled from an article. I think it was a New York Times article, and I didn't pull his first name, so I'm so sorry. But your last name is Newsom, and I bet it's not Gavin Newsom. It's another Newsom. But he said, quote, or he or she said, the question that we have asked everyone who passed by, and I think, let me backtrack a little bit. This quote was in regards to the protests and the Black Lives Matter, people who were a part of the Black Lives Matter movement, I guess, at this time. Mm-hmm. This was a person there that did a quote for the New York Times. So. Okay. I didn't get their first name, but Newsom said that, quote, "The question that we have asked everyone passing by and also placing flyers was, what would you do when a 60-year-old woman, a grandmother, swings a stick at you? You duck. You might hold up your hands to block it. You might even laugh, but you don't shoot that woman twice with a Smith & Wesson."
Yeah.
Newsom said that law enforcement and local governments have failed to adequately address the issue of police brutality towards the Black communities and people affected by mental health issues. And still, to this day, that has not been addressed.
Yep.
Deborah, in her essay, she warned of these fears, which, just like reading this essay and then like just all of the things that she was doing with her life, living with this illness, just does not, in my mind, that picture of her in her room, you know, just kind of spun out and not understanding what's going on, is a completely different person than I think of who's writing this this essay and mm-hmm. you know, who has a degree in computer science. Like, the way that they depict her in that one moment, the moments before her death, is like a completely different person. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the thing that we really need to understand, is that is a completely different person. Her illness is a completely different part of her that mm-hmm. that just, you know, without medication or without being able to deal with it in that moment, overcomes the real her. And
well, I would be careful about saying real her, because I think it's all real. Well, yeah,
I don't
her.
Mean like she's not human. I just mean like, or like that it is a part of her that she was living with, and it was mm-hmm. something that she, like,
but it overtakes the logic, it overtakes the rationale.
Yeah, and like them walking into that situation and seeing her the way that she was at the time, you know, it's taking away that irrational part of her, or the part of her that she'd lived every day and went to church every day and wrote this beautiful essay. You know, like, it's just hard to believe that, like, some officer or whoever, even like ESU, walking into that situation and having to, you know, de-escalate or kind of pull her back in and rein her back in, just feels so like it just gives me like this bad feeling, like, especially in her writing. Yeah. Because she does say the things that she, you know, the outcome of what happened is literally what she was writing 3-4 years before this happened.
Yeah.
In her writing, she said, quote, "We are all aware of the all too frequent news stories about the mentally ill who come up against law enforcement instead of a mental health professional and end up dead. We should all be aware that these circumstances represent very, very serious problems that need addressing. Teaching law enforcement how to deal with the mentally ill ill in crisis is crucial." Mm-hmm. Oh, that gives me chills, just because that is literally what happened to her. And she wrote about it 4 years before, and it felt like if somebody took that seriously 4 years before, she would still be here.
Yeah.
In a statement provided to the New York Times, the New York City Law Department confirmed that the city agreed to pay the Deborah's family $2 million in a settlement. Mm-hmm. They said, quote, "We carefully considered the facts impacting the civil claims against the city." I should say that Deborah's family sued the law enforcement. So that's mm-hmm. the settlement that they came up with. So they said, quote, "We carefully considered the facts impacting the civil claims against the city, including the criminal indictment of the responding officer and the disciplinary charges pending against him. This agreement is fit as a fair resolution of the tragic case and hopefully brings some measure of relief to the family. The city is committed to preventing these tragedies from happening," end quote. Mm. Mr. Aguirre, also didn't put his first name. Sorry, dude. he represented Jennifer Danner and Deborah's family. Mm-hmm. And he said that he felt that this settlement was fair. And Jennifer said that she feels good about finally having closure. The lawyer Aguirre also added that though he said that, you know, the settlement came, that he thought that the settlement was fair, he and his client urged Mayor de Blasio, Mr. O'Neill, who I believe is one of the city officials, to enhance training for patrol officers in dealing with emotionally disturbed people. Mm-hmm. But that wasn't something that was considered in the settlement. It was just like, that's what they urged them to do, even after taking the settlement. The New York Police Department has, but in the meantime, they were doing internal disciplinary charges against Sergeant Barry. There wasn't a trial date set as of 2018. And the charges that the department were against him were failing to follow police procedure governing the use of force when dealing with emotionally disturbed individuals. And according to the legal documents, and they accused him of failing in his supervisory capacity, which I was just like, well, duh.
Yeah.
Like, you're the senior person there, and you're the one that, like, literally takes somebody out because they swung a bat at you. Like, this seems like something a rookie would do.
Yeah.
Why are you a sergeant and you make such a fucked up mistake like that? So on December 13th, 2018, Andrew C. Quinn, he's the lawyer for Sergeant Barry, said that his client was on modified duty, meaning that he is basically stripped of all his privileges being a police officer, like, you know, and he was assigned to do administrative work in Manhattan. He did decline to comment about the settlement that the city gave to Deborah's family. But he did, you know, like most lawyers that back scumbags like him say, he said, quote, he did in fact follow his training, that Sergeant Barry did follow his training, and that he acted within the departmental guidelines during the episode. Yeah. But this, you know, first of all, it wasn't an episode, the murder, you should say. But this is like the main, and I think that people are so, they just don't understand what the defund the police really is.
Yeah.
And this is a huge aspect of that in a situation where the police aren't one, trained to deal with, two, just are there to protect and serve. But like, if in a situation where no one is like, no one there is doing anything criminal.
Yeah.
Like you're going to go there to what? Arrest someone who's going through a mental crisis? No, that's not your job. Your job is not to do that. You are not trained to deal with that situation. And we need to inform our law enforcement of mental health issues, and just to know that if there is no immediate threat to them, others, or the person in that situation, that they need to step out and allow somebody else who is trained to deal with that situation to come in and try to help. Obviously, if it becomes violent, or somebody's life is in danger, or the person who's having the crisis's life is in danger, then you can step in, but not forcefully.
Yeah,
that's just at the end of the day,
with the goal of de-escalating and saving lives and making sure everybody's safe and not hurt.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And even to call in people, like Jennifer was there.
Yeah.
She was there with her sister.
Ugh,
so like,
that's awful.
She could have got, they could have said, okay, you know, our ESU isn't able to, you know, calm her down. The police are not able to calm her down. Do you think that you can come in and you can try to see what you can do? They never did that. They never thought in a million years that somebody of her family could be able to help her in this situation. So I just feel like, you know, force in general is always excessive when you're dealing with a person who is suffering from a disease like this. Actually, any mental disease for that matter. So like, if you're going to go in and there's no other than de-escalating the situation or, you know, trying to calm this person down, anything outside of that is excessive force, regardless of especially coming from a police officer. So, you know, I think we just really need to keep in mind that situations like this, people who are dealing with these diseases like this are more of a threat to themselves and getting out of that situation is not the job of a police officer. We need to take care of the people who suffer from these mental illnesses and not kill them.
We would like to use this episode to help highlight mental health awareness for those living with mental or behavioral health issues and to help reduce the stigma so many experience. We will be providing links to educational and community resources available to you that may help on our Instagram at ontheirbehalf_pod. This week's episode was written and edited by me, Asia Hamilton, with music by Holly Amber Church and social media by Kelsey Gruenberg.
For pictures and sources, please follow us on Instagram at ontheirbehalf_pod and on Twitter at ontheirbehalf_.
Please rate, review, and subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen.
On Their Behalf, thank you for listening.